Ecclesiastes chapter 3. We're going to read verse 1 through verse 15 this morning. Let's see what God has for us. Ecclesiastes 3:1, for everything there is a season, a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. This is the word of the Lord. Fear, reverence, awe. These are words used in the Bible to describe how we, the image bearers, people made in God's image, how we should respond to God, how our hearts should be positioned before the one God, the one true and living God, the maker of heaven and earth, the sovereign one who rules freely, reigns freely over all creation, the free one who upholds all things by the word of his power, fear, reverence, awe. And those same words are used by us to describe how we respond to so many other things. So reverence. Lord willing, you would agree that a place like Arlington National Cemetery is a place of reverence. You don't go there and play tag, do you? You go there and you're quiet. You just reflect on all that that cemetery means, all that it took for men and women, all that they lost, all that we lost for that cemetery to be there. It's a place of reverence. But fear, I don't know, a tornado, a wild dog, a snake, holy cow. Fear. I think of awe, maybe just a spectacular lightning bolt, or the Grand Canyon, or a sunset. It just stirs your heart to maybe stand up and just be quiet. Awe of what you're seeing. But God, fear, reverence, awe, why do we forget God? Why do we take matters into our own hands as if we're the one that's in control? It's up to us to get it done. Be still. Awe. Think about how loosely and how quickly we throw out the word awesome to describe what? A pie? A song? What? And think of how rarely awesome is used to describe God. Again, when you read the scriptures, fear, reverence, awe. That's how the Bible describes people responding to God. So then what is it? What is it about Arlington, or what is it about a lightning bolt or the Grand Canyon? Is it that we can see it and we can't see God? Probably. That's probably a factor. But I contend it's not just that we cannot see God. It's that we don't consider God. We don't perceive God. That is, if we would just slow down and take in all that God has done, all that God is presently doing, and all that God will do, I don't think we would have to work or encourage one another to stand in awe of God. I think it's that we don't see Him and we don't perceive Him, and we're kind of okay with that. Maybe you remember in the Old Testament, Israel trembled when God sent this burst of lightning down on Mount Sinai to say, "I am here." But what happened to Israel when the spectacular signs ceased? They didn't tremble. Instead, they turned away from the Lord, taking matters into their own hands, losing all reverence, fear of the Lord. But that same thing happened later in the Old Testament with King Solomon, the one who wrote Ecclesiastes, the one who was the king of Israel, the one who personally knew God, the one who had heard the very voice of God. The reason he had wisdom and knowledge and wealth and authority and influence, the whole reason he could set out on this grand exploration that he gives us here in Ecclesiastes, all of that happened because God did it. God granted him the wisdom. God granted him the wealth. God granted him the knowledge. God granted him all of those things. But he lost reverence for God. He lost awe of God. Like us, like Israel, he looked away from God, trying to take matters into his own hands. And so Solomon here, seeking to find meaning, he's asking the question that so many of us ask, like, what's the point? Why do I get out of bed? Why do I work so hard? Why do I make so many sacrifices? Why do I walk with integrity? Why do I lie and try to get ahead? Why do I cheat? Asking that great why question. What's the point? What's the meaning? Where is fulfillment, significance in life realized? He looked to wisdom. He looked to knowledge. He looked to all of these, indulging in all of these pleasures. He looked to bringing the nations before him, to give him and to dote all over him. He looked to women. He looked to all of these things, and every one of these things promised him, there you will find joy. Come on, come walk down this road. Come taste this thing. Come experience this thing, and you will know joy. But we know it only gave him disappointment and despair. That is, he looked away from God. And he looked to all of these things, some of these things good, some of these things wicked. He looked to all of these things for meaning and fulfillment, promising so much, but only giving him sadness and disappointment. And we know Solomon and his experience is not unique, is it? He may not be the king of Israel, and nobody from all of the nations is coming to hear us speak, but we can just look in the mirror and go, boy, I was duped again. I fell for that lie yet again. I thought I could just look away from God and give my heart to this thing or to this person or whatever it is, and then my life would be full. Then my life would be satisfied. And what do we have? The same heart sorrow of King Solomon. Well, that was a waste. Because that's what he's saying. Well, that was a waste. And now, having come to his senses, having now lived all of these years of exploration, he's looking back, having come to his senses, he's looking back on all of that, and he's talking to this gathered assembly, maybe like us today, and he is saying to them, and now in time, he is saying to us in this passage here in chapter 3, that God is working all things in a way that calls for us to stand in awe of him. You want to know what all of this is about? You want to know what all of these times and moments of life are ultimately about? Awe. Beholding God and having reverence for God. So in chapters 1 and 2 of Ecclesiastes, he gave us this, we've said like an autobiographical moment where he's articulating his personal experiences. But in chapter 3, he opens up a new section of this book where he moves from personal experience to maybe we would say like wise principles about life. And where he wants us to start is where he ends this book. Fear God. Fear God. Have deep, like mouth and heart silencing reverence. The one true and living God, the maker of heaven and earth. So I stand here today and contend fear, reverence, awe, we're not lacking in those. We're very much like Israel. If the Lord were to show up with a bolt of lightning and have our attention, right? But while we sit in the cave like Elijah, asking God, where are you? And he comes to us in the still small voice, we go, no, no, no. We're looking for wind. We're looking for fire. We're looking for something big and spectacular. But we don't have an awe problem. We have it in us. It's just misdirected. And this word from Solomon here inspired by the Holy Spirit, is intending to call our hearts back to the reality why we have awe, reverence, why fear exists in this world. And it is to behold God, who is reigning over all things. And so he's gonna articulate these things first by giving us this very beautiful and famous poem from Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8. And then in verses 9 through 15, he's going to explain the meaning of the poem. So let's look at this poem here. This simple poem. He begins with this matter-of-fact assertion. And I think there's a place for this. I think you see this in the life of Jesus. I'm not going to argue with you. I'm going to assert this thing. So Lord willing, led by the Spirit with humble hearts, we will just assert truth and let truth do the work that only it can do. And so he asserts a truth right here in verse 1. For everything there is a season, a time for every matter under heaven. He doesn't argue it. He just asserts it. And I love that because it's true. Like it or not, it is true. And he's saying there's an appropriate time, there's an appropriate moment for everything. Life is not random. Life is not merely coincidental. God has appointed a time for everything. The key to this entire section, I've referenced it many times, but it's found in verse 14 where it says, God has done it. They're talking about these times. God has done it so that people fear him. So when he says that there is a time, or there is a, for everything there is a season, a time for every matter under heaven, we need to hear that and go, because God did it. That's a sufficient sermon in and of itself right there. God has done it. And I hope that both strikes a curiosity in your heart and quiets your heart at the same time. God has done it so that people should fear before him. So that has to be the shining light that informs everything else we read here about a time for everything. And this poem is now going to illustrate the assertion of verse 1. And as you read this, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up, don't you start to see that maybe now we should look back and see a pendulum swinging back and forth as he works his way through these scenarios that he gives right here. And generally speaking, he's moving back and forth, swinging back and forth between maybe what we would call desirable and undesirable. And 28 times he uses the word time. 4 times in each of the 7 verses. And 7 is this biblical number for completion. So think about the 7 days of creation. And so again, these 7 verses complete with about time is Solomon's poetic, beautiful, God-inspired way of saying, I'm speaking completely about life. I don't have to mention every single scenario of life that you may encounter in this age or in future generations. I am speaking comprehensively, exhaustively, completely about life from beginning to end. And did you notice how the poem began in verse 2? There is a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. So he starts and he ends here with the start and the end of life, the bookends of life, of being born and dying. And we know no one of us gets to decide to be born. Nobody gets to decide when the right time to be born is. That's something that is decided for us. And likewise, we don't get to decide the time to die. Yes, I know, and it is sad and it is painful that some do take that decision into their own hands. But they didn't decide the circumstances, the pain, the grief, the loss, the tragedy, that led them to take such a tragic action against themselves and against God. So even death, it's not our decision. All of this is saying there's these things happening in this world that you are reacting to. You are not God. You are not in control. And beginning with birth and ending with death, it's shouting to us, God is God. And he's got it under control. I mean, you think about how many of us took every wise precaution to not have children. And the Lord said, watch me work. I will surprise you. Or how many of us will step to have children? And God said, no. or not now. See, it's not ultimately our decision. It's the Creator. It's the Sustainer's decision. And so we love God when He says, I will surprise you. And we trust God when He says, no, not right now, or no, never. Aren't we, like trying to prepare for birth, also trying to avoid death? I don't know anybody. I do not know anybody that's trying to shape their life to die quickly. Most of us are taking steps to avoid it. That's certainly the mode of this world. Let's avoid death, unless it's the unborn womb or the unborn baby in the womb, and then they decide to kill and to murder. But here he's saying a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant, so we're running parallel now with being born, and a time to pluck up what is planted parallel to death. We don't get the freedom to decide when spring is or when winter is, right? No matter how badly we don't want winter to come, winter's coming. No matter how much we want spring to be today, oh, we've got to endure the summer, don't we? So we don't get to decide when the right time is to plant or to pluck. Planting is planting, plucking is plucking, all according to God's all-wise plan. So again, Solomon here is inviting the hearers, now inviting us to stand with him and see this pendulum swinging back and forth between the desirable and the undesirable. And this is a full and busy poem, right? So he says there's a time to plant in the spring. There's a time to pluck up what is planted at the harvest. There's a right time to kill. Notice it does not say murder. There's not a right time for murder. It's always wrong. But there is a right time to kill. Maybe in self-defense or maybe in a just war. But that also means there's a right time to heal after the war. When the peace treaty has been signed, maybe one that was an enemy during the war and now that it's been signed, we need to come along and nurture back to health. There's a time to break down, such as tearing down idols of worship. And there's a time to build up, such as a house of worship or a house for your own good and prosperity. There's a time for weeping when a loved one dies. There's a time for dancing when a loved one is born again, or maybe when a loved one gets married. There's a right time to cast away stones. So you're going through the field and you're picking up stones because you need to prepare for sowing the seed in that field. But there's also a right time to gather stones together. That is, you want to protect the field from the war. So whereas before you would go through the field to pick up, to gather these stones over here, now you're going back through the field and you're casting the stones back in because war is coming and you know the enemy is going to trample up all the fields if they can. Or maybe you just want to build a wall. But there's a time for gathering up these stones. There's a time to embrace. A wayward child comes home, but maybe not even wayward, just the child came home from school today, and your heart races and is thrilled. But then there's a time to refrain from embracing, and so maybe that's something like a worldwide pandemic. There's a time to seek, so something valuable is lost, your keys, your wallet, a child. Maybe even it's a pet, which I don't understand, but maybe so. There's a time to seek, but there's a time to cast away. So we take out the trash every Wednesday. Or maybe it's a toxic relationship that you need to end and get away from. There's a time to tear. You tear the sleeves off to form a tourniquet, or like Job when he lost his children, and he tore his clothes in grief. But then there's a time to sow. Maybe when the time of mourning has ended and you're back to having a quiet peace with the Lord, you sew those clothes up, or something new is happening and you make something new, you sew it. There's also a time to keep silence. And some of us need to know this because we feel like we got to comment on so much. There's a time for silence. And I want you to think about Jesus when he was slandered. Didn't answer him back, did he? And then there's a time to speak. And I want you to think about Jesus as he died. It is finished. So again, we have this fast, busy, comprehensive poem from God here that's moving us back and forth, and it brings us to this conclusion in verse 8, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Love and peace. These are the first and last of this last verse of this perfect poem. And it's giving us this reminder of God's beginning, this creation work where He made everything because He loves. And the culmination of all of God's work in Christ, it will bring peace to all of this creation. And sandwiched in between His good work of creation and this culminating work of Christ in peace is what? Hate and war. And so He's giving us a simple, concise statement, a perfect statement about the reality of life under the sun. It comes about because God is love. In between love and peace, you will have a life marked by hatred and marked by war. But do know hatred and war do not get the final word. Peace gets the final word. And so this poem, inspired by God, written by Solomon, is intended to leave us at a place where we say, how long? How long, O Lord, until the time of hate and the time of war has passed away and we can walk in the fullness now of the time of peace? And you have to know Solomon was asking that with us, because he had set out and he had experienced all these times thinking it was going to give him something good, only bringing him despair. And he is now saying, I'm not yet there. I'm not yet there. But I've learned peace is not realized in all of these other areas that I was looking at, which then leads us now into the explanation of the poem. Now he tells us why he said what he just said right here. And this is glorious. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he's put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's good gift. This is God's gift to man. So verse 1 through verse 8, they're telling us these verses are telling us our experience inside of time, to which then Solomon responds to such a declaration in verse 9, saying, well, what's the point of it then? And then he gives us in verses 10 through 15 an explanation of the point of it, in particular, what God is doing, God's role in time, and how we should respond. So maybe we would say this, verses 1 through 8 have us at ground level looking back up at this pendulum of time, and then verses 9 through 15 have us looking back down at this pendulum of time. And he's saying to us, hey, y'all, stand in awe of God. As you see all that he's doing, stand in awe of the God who is in control of all things. Didn't you see the hand of God all over this when you read these verses with me here? Verse 10, he said, I have seen the business God has given. So this is going to come, like if you're just reading through Ecclesiastes sequentially, just on a Monday morning, you say, oh, I'm going to read through Ecclesiastes. It's kind of bummer, those early chapters. And I've heard that from some of you, like how many sermons are you going to preach from Ecclesiastes, man? I don't know. And so we're reading through it and it's like, and then we come to chapter 3 and it's like the light just explodes in our face here when he acknowledges the good presence of God in all of this. That the good presence of God defines all of these times. I have seen the business that God has given the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. You see, unlike the animals, we're curious about history. I know you love your dog or your cat, but that cat doesn't give a rip about last year, nor about next year. But we do. And we're curious about the future. But not just the future on earth. What happens after we die? Unlike animals, we're meaning seekers. I recently took a handful of my kids, and I have enough kids that I can have two handfuls of kids, if you don't know. I took a handful of my kids, and we hiked up to the Black Mountain. And you know, if you've never been there, there's an American flag, and you can, it's a pretty spectacular view, right, for those of you who have been up there. And I thought, a dog has never made it to the top and went, wow, look at all this. A dog maybe looked at its owner and said, that was really hard, or that was like, you want to do it again? But the dog never sat down with its mouth open in awe. God did not put eternity into an animal's heart. God did not put that curiosity about eternity into an animal's heart. He put it into our hearts. And that's why we're meaning seekers. That's why we're meaning makers if we don't know the Lord. That's why we worship our children or our pets or our accomplishments or whatever if God is not at the center of our hearts. We will awe someone or something. We will worship someone or something if the Lord is not at the center. And so we read this and say, well, that kind of makes sense. God has put eternity into our hearts. That makes sense why I long for relief from futility. I long to know, does my life even matter? I wonder, did anyone ask that question this week? Do I even matter? I've asked that question more than I ever thought I would ask it. And maybe midlife crisis stuff has me asking it more. Maybe I'm looking to some of you to say, that too will pass. You'll be content soon enough. But like I'm in that season right now where I look back and I feel like, oh man, I'm maybe closer to the end than the beginning. And what do I have to show for it? When I take my eyes off of the Lord, that's inevitably where I go. What's the point of it? What have I done that's significant? What have I done that will benefit people? And I'm sitting here thinking, how long, Lord, until that's taken away? How long until my heart is truly free from that curiosity? And in many ways, the answer is never. It's going to be redeemed when you see me, though. And for all eternity, you will seek and seek and seek. And not be disappointed about what you haven't yet learned, but enthralled by what's on the horizon. God has put eternity into our hearts. So we're curious about it, and we desire relief from this vain, futile, burdensome existence. Someone said of this particular passage here, this section of God's Word, they said, God gave us a key to a door to unlock something wonderful, but didn't tell us at first where the door was or what was beyond the door. But here we learn the door is eternity. But still, we don't yet know where to find the door. But we today know what? Jesus is the door. Because He told us that. And so as we come to Him with humble hearts, we come to Him with this meaning-seeking desire. We come to Him with the desire to be set free from the bondage of sin and from the futility of work here in this world. We come to Him with all of this eternal desire, and we say, here I am, Lord. Nothing in my hands I bring, simply to Thy cross I cling. Here am I, Lord. The door opens to us. And we walk in and we find that relief. And it's only the first fruit of that relief. It's not the fullness of the relief yet. But yet many will hear me say what I just said and go, no thanks. Because I tell people all the time. And it's almost like a pat on the head. It's good for you. But no thanks. And what do they do then? They keep seeking meaning. They keep looking for answers and significance. And so they look to education or work or wealth or experiences. Or they look to wisdom or knowledge or whatever these things. These very same things Solomon sought sought out to find meaning. They go look for those same exact things. And I'm here to tell you, their confession in time will be the same confession that was made popular in 1987 by the rock and roll band U2. Any U2 fans here? I still haven't found what I'm looking for. You ought to go listen to that song. It's a Christian. They're all Christians, and they wrote it from the perspective of Ecclesiastes. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Go look it up. It's a great, great song. Well, Solomon, he had been there and he had done that, and he realized, I didn't find what I was looking for there or there or there or there. So he came to his senses when he writes in verse 10 again, I've seen the business God has given the children of man to be busy with. The business of figuring out every matter under heaven. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. If we humble ourselves before God, trusting in Him that He makes everything beautiful, everything right in its time, trusting that God really does work all things together for good, we can then and only then embrace the goodness and the gift that He articulates for us in verses 12 and 13. I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. So, a summary of those verses could be, under the goodness of God's sovereign control of all things, we should be happy and holy. What is God's will for you today? Trust Him, and as you trust Him, to be happy and holy. It ain't rocket science. It's faith. You just think about this for a moment. All the complexity is not complex to God, right? We've got more questions than our minds can even process. And it all looks so tangled. It all looks so complex. God's not anxious. It's pretty pedestrian to the eternal God. So what that means is we don't have to be burdened by it. We don't have to try to figure it all out. In other words, a lot of people will say to me that something along the lines of, God gave me a brain, I need to use it. I agree, right? So do your homework, read books, you know, so forth and so on. But to figure out those secret things that belong to the Lord, that's not God's will. They're secret things for a reason. But this tells us right here what His will is. To come underneath the canopy of His might, of His wisdom, of His love, of His goodness, and to live on the foundation of His strength, His holiness, His righteousness, and to be happy and holy as He's over you and as He's under you. So I mean this literally. Why be anxious when God has it? I'm serious. I want you to ask your heart that, and maybe you're not there today and you're like, praise the Lord, I have to write it down because soon enough you will visit anxiety. You don't have to live with her or him. Anxiety may visit you, just pass along your front door, may try to sit down next to you in the car and whisper into your ear. So ask, why be anxious if God is in control? Better assert, I will not be anxious because God is in control. So what Solomon is saying is one of the blessed realities of life is when you arrive at that moment, and maybe we would say that new reality, that new season of life where you let God be God. And you let God orchestrate all things. And you don't rush Him. And you don't take matters into your own hands to fix your children or to fix your grandchildren or to fix your spouse or to fix your neighbor or to fix this world. You let God be God. And you stay in your lane. Being happy and being holy. Being faithful in the things He's put before you. Working, getting up each day, going to work. Getting up each day, living for the glory of God. Going to bed each day. I told someone this week, you know the best way you can honor someone? Eat. Because that one was anxious. That one was troubled. And by not eating was functionally saying, I don't believe God has this under control. I need to be worried. I need to be up, scurrying. I need to be doing. No. You could show that you trust the Lord by having a good, hearty meal today. And I wonder if anyone here needs to hear that today. Eat lunch and not feel bad about it. Go to bed tonight and not feel bad about it. Trust God has all of this. And so He says, eat, drink, work, take joy, be faithful in the various seasons of life, the time of life, the time of death, the time of tearing, the time of sowing, the time of building, the time of tearing down, the time of weeping, the time of dancing. In all of these things, trust Him. He's got it. He's got it all under control. He's keeping it all together. That is, He's making all things beautiful right in their time. Now, right now, it doesn't look that way, does it? Right now, as we're down in verses 1 through 8, looking up at the swinging pendulum of time, we look up at the backside of the tapestry of God's work, and boy, it looks knotty. It looks tangled. It looks confusing, right? But in time, He's going to draw us up to look on the top side of the tapestry of His work. And because it already is, when we get there, we will agree. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And Lord, I couldn't see the beauty. And He says, I know. And so when we say right now, Lord, I don't see the beauty, He says, I know. Trust me. I'm making it beautiful. And soon enough, you're going to join me and you're going to see the beauty of it all. Yes, I know you can't find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. But what you do know, what you and I know, is the same thing Solomon knew in verse 14. I perceive whatever God does, it endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken away from it. God has done it so that people should fear Him. God's ways are not going to change. That's what we would say, the immutable ways of God. God is immutable. Aren't you glad that no one, okay, I hope everyone's listening right now, no one is going to thwart God. No one. And I'm not primarily talking about some elected official or some crazy dictator. I'm talking about you and me when we're anxious in the morning or anxious in the evening. No one to thwart God's plan. Not a single person has more strength or wisdom than God. But also, not every single person together has more strength, more wisdom than God. Is that not incredible? But also, let's just say for a moment, with intellectual horsepower, we could get on par with God. All of us put our heads together, we'd get on par with God. You know what the problem would still be? Doggone it, He's good and we're not. We're tainted with sin. And He's got it. This is what I'm talking about, this canopy of God and this foundation of God. He's Christ before us, Christ behind us, Christ under us, Christ above. Like, He's holding all things together by the word of His power. We were just looking in my Sunday school class about the Tower of Babel, and they really thought they could overthrow God. In fact, God said nothing will be impossible for them, right? And so what did God do to deal with this grand, impossible work that they're doing? Like, oh my goodness, I'm going to overthrow them? He just said, I'll disperse them. Why be anxious when all the nations rage against God? And He says, I'll disperse them, and they're scattered. We think He doesn't have us. That's why the song we prayed was profound. It's because we're saying, Lord, I know all of these things to be true. The preacher didn't say anything new today. Would you help the unbelief that still lives in my heart? Because many times I find it hard to trust that You're making everything beautiful. And I'd really like to grab the steering wheel again and turn my family this way or turn my life this way, God. So He looks at us and says, trust me. We say, yes. Because You're good. And yes, because You're wise. Yes, because You are in control and You're using all of those glorious attributes for Your glory and my good. You see, God really is free. He is free. And He's doing things that we can't even fathom right now. I said, I think recently in a sermon, we're playing checkers, He's playing chess. Ridiculous to say. Like, He's playing, I don't even know, infinite games of chess and checkers and whatever. And we're over there playing tic-tac-toe. He's saying, come on. I've got it. You know, Jesus said, are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And yet not one of them fall to the ground apart from Your Father. That's air traffic control at a pretty detailed level. What's most amazing is the person I just referenced said that. Miss Judy, at the beginning of our service, read for us from John 1. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was God. right? And then she read, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. See, what's most incredible about this whole thing is the God who is over time, the God who is over all of this and holding it all together. He came inside of time, and he humbled himself to the boundaries of time, and he dwelt among us. And the Apostle Paul said in Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a virgin, born under the law, to redeem those under the law, so that we, that is, we in time, we under the law, we might receive adoption as sons. And because we are sons, God has sent his Spirit, the Spirit of his Son, into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So when we read this time for peace and we say, how long, O Lord, it's a testimony that Jesus is who he says he is. Jesus did what he said he was going to do. And the Spirit now lives in us, and we cry out, how long, O Lord? Father, help! Father, rescue! Father, deliver! So you are no longer a slave, but a son, and if a son, then an heir through God. So we should worship the one that submitted himself to the cycle, to the rhythm of time and life under the sun. He didn't have to. He did it because he's good and because he loves us. He did it to redeem and to adopt those who groan for him from under the sun. There was a time for the Son of God to be born. And there was a time for the Son of God to die. And hallelujah, there was a time for the Son of God to rise from the grave and ascend to the Father's right hand, where he rules and he reigns right now. And for us, those who know him, those who have trusted in him, having turned from that selfish ambition, trying to take matters into our own hands, trusting that he is good, trusting that he is wise, we can say, help, Father. Quiet me, Father. Give me peace. I wait for your return, O Lord. See, we're no longer slaves to sin, but we're no longer slaves to meaningless. We're no longer slaves to the life that says, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. We've tasted and seen that the Lord is good. And so when he says, be still and know that I am God, we say, hallelujah, you've got it. And I can be still and know that you are the Lord. So, let God be God, because Christ is King, and the Spirit lives in us so that we stand in awe, so that we fear him and do all for his glory. And you know what fearing God and doing all for his glory looks like? Sometimes it means eat, drink, and find joy in whatever God has designated for your life. It's staying in your lane, letting God be God, being content with who you are, how he made you, the gifts, the ambitions that he's given you. You color within the lines of the boundaries that God has given you. You eat, you drink, you pursue personal holiness, you do all for his glory. And you know that God has, is, and will always, until his return, seek what has been driven away. That's where this ends. God seeks what has been driven away. So we sit here today and in June of 2021, right? June of 2020. Good gracious, that just sounds so weird to say. And we still, all these years after the fall of Adam and Eve, all these years after Solomon writing this, all these years after the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, we still live in a world full of men and women, image bearers, made in the image of God, with eternity written on their hearts, but because of sin have been driven away. And what also has not changed? Seeking. God is still seeking today what has been driven away. Jesus told us that much. He said he came to seek and to save the lost, right? Isn't that what he told us when he sought out Zacchaeus? So what Solomon is putting into our heart and our minds this morning is the sovereign God is the seeking God. Do you know why you're here today? Because you and I need to be reminded God is seeking you. God is seeking you, not to harass you, not to teach you a lesson, but to quiet you, to calm you, to comfort you, to strengthen and establish you. Now, friend, if you have not repented, grieved, hated your sin, and turned from it, you should not expect the Lord just to come alongside and say, now, it's okay. Because he gave his son so that he could quiet you. And so he's pursuing you, if you don't know him, so that you will grieve and hate your sin, including the sin of taking matters into your own hands and being anxious. And he wants to quiet you from that. If you will let go, if you will let him be God, and you will say, God, you are wise and you are good, and I'm not. I thought I was. I did the best I knew how to do. And so if you don't know Jesus personally, intimately, have a personal relationship with Jesus, friend, why not? On behalf of every redeemed sinner here, we want to say, come on in. He's good. He will begin to quiet your heart now, and it's only the beginning. And he will begin to comfort you in your sorrow now, and it's only the beginning. He will relieve your burdens now and forever. Come on in. He is good. He's not the ticket to something better. He is better. He is the something better that your heart is crying out for. So come on in and trust Christ. And for those that are already in, to the redeemed brothers and sisters, I want to encourage you, it's okay to trust him, to rest in him. He's got it. You see, this is where we will end. If he's got it, then he's got you. And he's got you. And he's got you. And we just go around the room. He's got you. Why? Oh, to quiet your heart. You don't have to pull it together to say something to him. You don't have to find the eloquent way. Just be still in his presence and let him be him. And look back on your life and say with me, oh, I guess God was doing something there that I couldn't see in the moment. And as he has been, he is, and forever will be. So let's trust him and rest in him until we see the top half of that tapestry. Wow. Lord, I wish I could go back and do it again now. Let's trust him.